E2.
Number 23B.
It gives us a sense of resurrection of the mortal to be the idea, the perfect man. And he shows it, that it resurrects us step by step. And that's why he shows again the whole letter which he writes in the word order. So that he shows how claiming that we are the idea of mind resurrects us to be the idea of mind. That claiming the idea that we are the idea of spirit resurrects us to be the idea of spirit. And so a step-by-step evolution takes place. You see, all these epistles have within themselves a certain order. Mostly there is the Christ order or the Word order, or sometimes the four. So according to the subject that is under discussion, he will show that point of intersection through the seven or through the four in one or the other order. That's clear. But I don't go into that order. That's in the book and that's secondary. The main thing is that we first have an overall view of what is meaning the term Christianity, that it means really our true relationship in understanding Word, Christ, Christianity and science, and that has a terrific power of consciousness working on us and bringing man to the point of completion. All right, I made a little side mark, so I have to go back to the order here. We are in 1 Thessalonians, showing there that Paul writes them and says, claim your perfection as the idea man, as the perfect idea man, and claiming it and staying with it, it begins to transform you and you become step by step that very idea man. He has to write them again soon afterwards because he could see that this didn't do quite the trick, that not everyone could make the grade, and that he has to tell them a step more. Namely, now we come to Christianity as Christianity at the point of intersection, where he asks them not to give in seeing and admitting themselves as the idea of God. And that only by doing that they will triumph. It is some kind of saying the same thing in that epistle as when Mrs. Eddy said, the admission to oneself that man is God's own likeness. This is the admission, that claiming, that steadfastly claiming that we are the idea of God, that we are God's own likeness, sets man free to master the infinite idea, gives them triumph, gives them dominion. And this is the more or less the tone here too in 2 Thessalonians, that he urges the Thessalonians to go on in their faith and to see that man is perfect, so that by steadfastly abiding by the perfect idea to be the Son of God, they would win a victory over what? He calls it the Son of Perdition. Can you see the beauty that here, where we have really the victory over the mortal, he calls that mortal, I guess they didn't have a term for calling it the mortal, that perhaps our term or Mrs. Eddy's term, he called them the Son of Perdition, compared with the Son of God. So here you have the disappearance, really, of the Son of Perdition, the mastery over the Son of Perdition. So that within us, he says, the Son of God, or man's perfection, gains a triumph, and the false sense of man just begins to yield, and so we can demonstrate, really, the actual experience of the perfection of man. Yes. Then we have the three letters of John, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John. I can't tell you in a few minutes what John really conveys. John is always the great scientific thinker in the New Testament. His Gospel of John is written in the science order. He deviates completely in his presentation of Jesus from Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Matthew, Mark, and Luke more or less have some kind of similar connotation, though they present Jesus, the one from the point of view of the word order, then Mark from the Christ order, and then Luke from the Christianity order. But they all focus, so to say, more on the outward signs of Jesus' life, presenting really Jesus as man, like in Luke. But when John writes about him, it's so very different. There are very few parallel passages in John which one can compare with the other three Gospels. And interestingly enough, he only takes a few healing that are in the other three Gospels. But when he takes them, he talks at length about them, as if he would say, I show you the science of demonstration, the science of healing that laid behind the presentation of those healing in the first three Gospels. So he's a quite a different caliber than the other three. And also, naturally, you can see that the first three Gospels were written in the 60s, whereas John wrote 30 years later. And naturally, in 30 years, one matures. One gets a deeper insight into being. So can you see, say, Jesus left us around about 30. The three first Gospels were written about 30 years later, and John's Gospel was written another 30 years later, and much later than all the other epistles have been written, like Paul's epistle. He started very soon after Jesus has left us. He started writing these epistles, and I think the last ones were around about 60. So again, you could see there was a great lapse of time between 60 and 90 and nearly 100 when he wrote the Apocalypse, where practically nothing was written anymore fundamental. It must have been a great time of consolidating one's understanding. What was that phenomenon called Jesus? What was it all about? Was it just a wonder? And it must have been a terrific sense of heart-searching or understanding-searching, of science-searching in that period. Until then, John would write his Gospel on Jesus. You see, nearly 60 years later. And we can see how today, say, we look at Mrs. Eddy and her discovery after 60 years of her passing quite different than at her time. It's a completely different view, completely different perspective. Or if we look even at John Dolly, who left us about 25 years ago, we see him today quite different than when he left us. We gained somehow distance, perspective, and suddenly begin to be able to put them into a much bigger picture than we could do while we were right with him and right at the point of going on with him and trying to catch up with him, and therefore being more or less within a smaller framework of thinking. And only then, afterwards, slowly we broke out in our consciousness and began to see what is his place value in the whole development of not only of the spiritual idea of Christian Science, but also much more in the development of the whole world consciousness. This is much more interesting and much more bigger than to put John Dolly constantly only within the frame of reference of the Christian Science line of development. This is too small. He may not even be aware of it, but he is a much bigger caliber than that to have a place value within the development of the Christian Science idea. He has a terrific place value in the development of the science idea in the world. Science, small s, the investigation of reality through scientific means, there he has his big place value. Because he would be a pioneer without knowing it in so many fields that afterwards the various sciences have taken up and have begun to build their sciences on quite a new paradigm, quite new methods and things like that. Oh, I went away from my subject again, but sometimes it's necessary to pinpoint, so to say, the contribution that some of these writers made, like here John. He wrote those three epistles. The first epistle was a bit bigger than the second and third. Actually, the second and third are so small that they only take up about a third of a page or half a page in the Bible. Most of it is then even an introduction, because when you write, you say, "Hello, my dears, and hello, you, and you, and you, and you, you see, and how are you, and I hope everything is okay," and then you start the letter, and you end the letter by saying, "Give my greetings to so-and-so, and so-and-so," see, and then only a little part in between is left for the real thing. So, but interestingly enough, you see, John's mentality was always working in the four. Whatever he presented was always in the four. He presented the gospel of John, presenting therefore the phenomena of Jesus in the four, namely in the candlestick order, which is the seven built in the four of work, Christ, Christianity, and science. He wrote the first epistle, and what he presented was again the four orders. And then afterwards, in the second and third epistle, he dropped the seven in the four and just was writing about the four. So his accent shifted more from the seven to the four. Naturally, then finally, when he wrote the Apocalypse, then the seven were subordinate, really, always more to the four and to the levels of science, of Christian Science, absolute Christian Science, divine science, science itself. That was finally his great insight into being, that thought had to rise through the levels of science and reach the climax of the highest level, from where he would look down to the universe and see and contemplate the universe from the highest aspect of science, and including all the other levels. What John was therefore showing here, what man should do, what is man's relationship to the perfect idea of man, would be defined through the horizontal of science, that we have to prove that perfection through living. And he said, what is living? You have to live the calculus. You have to be the calculus. So that man is living according to the divine infinite calculus. And by doing that, the calculus proves itself. So he was very, very hot at the four word, Christ, Christianity, and science. Let's go to the last vertical science. Here, the dominant tone, the vertical is the dominant, is showing the science of man, the scientific men, again, perhaps we see that clearer when we just quickly blend back to the Christ matrix. If you blend back to the Christ matrix, we had in this vertical, we said that the idea operates in its principle. And here actually you have the other aspect, that the principle operates as its idea. That's really the science of man. That principle operates as its own idea, and that is the scientific way of salvation. They show here a great sense of what constitutes a Christian scientist. Actually, at that time they didn't call them a Christian scientist, but what constitutes a Christian when he is teaching a principle, a science. So that man here at this point really is shown as a Christian scientist in the way that he is not just a divine scientist or a scientist, but a Christian, namely a scientist that finds the way of salvation on the even road of understanding. No more through the road of suffering and tribulation and all these things. Here in this vertical, are really shown always the road of salvation by using the divine principle as our principle and being therefore a scientist. The first box here of science as the word, we have the pastoral epistles. There are three epistles that you can take together as the so-called pastoral epistles, combining first letter to Timothy, second letter to Timothy, and the letter to Titus. What were Timothy and Titus? Timothy and Titus were the instructors, the teachers, that Paul sent to various places in the Aegean islands, like Crete, you call it Crete, that island. So he is writing to them how to be a teacher. What is asked of them? That they can be acknowledged by the church as an example, as a teacher, as a leader. See? So he is showing really that in order to be a scientist, they must really stick very closely to the principles that Paul has laid down and taught them. Again, you hear something similar to the chapter Teaching Christian Science, where we also saw that by abiding by the principle we become a Christian scientist, and very much so here, only that it has much more a human connotation and human touch here in the pastoral epistles. He shows that they should accept their unity with the science of man. And if they do that, that they become really the teachers of salvation, that they would actually be able to lead the church out of their difficulties and bring them to salvation. These three are showing actually first, Timothy is showing how they should sustain always the principle like in the church. In 2 Timothy, that they should protect always that which is principle like in those churches. And to Titus, he wrote how he should always promote that in the church with its principal like. There are fine letters, so to say, which are written to us, to each one of us, who trying his best, say, to lead the students, to instruct the students, so to say, that one should be an example to the students, and it shows what are the pitfalls, what he shouldn't do, and so on. It's a kind of manual he gives them for how to behave and what he should watch, so that it would really help the church. When it comes to signs as Christ, we come to that short epistle to Philemon, that little pearl of the epistles, a straightforward, gentle letter of great magnitude, showing what? Again, the way of salvation. But how? Really, that by claiming our way of salvation, by claiming that we are operating no more as people, but operating as an idea of principle, that if we do that, that if we operate as the idea of principle, that then we are free under every circumstance. No matter what the circumstances may be, we are a free man. Do you know the Epistle of Philemon? You know, Philemon was apparently a rich man somewhere in Asia Minor, or wherever it was, and he had a slave called Onesimus. You call it Onesimus? Yeah. Oh, I haven't asked. And he had a slave, and that slave apparently had stolen something from his master Philemon and ran away, and perhaps he has stolen the money to be able to go to Rome and visit Paul in the prison. So he stole the money, ran away, went to Paul, visited him in prison, and offered his service to Paul to help him and to serve him. Paul at that time was held in custody. You call it custody? Yes. He wasn't sentenced, so he was treated apparently quite decently there, so he could have a help and a servant and things like that, and Onesimus was serving him. And then Paul wrote this letter to Philemon and gave that letter to Onesimus to bring it home to Philemon. And in that letter he wrote to Philemon that he should take Onesimus back, and that he asked him, he doesn't command it, and he asked him not to punish him, but to set him free, no more to accept him as a slave. See, it's interesting, up to that point, Paul was preaching a lot in those various churches all over Asia Minor. And in those churches there were free people and slaves as Christians. And Onesimus must have been one of these slave Christians. And up to that point he always preached that the slave should be a better slave than a non-Christian slave. He never preached that they should be free. He said, you are a slave, all right, try as a Christian to show that you can be a better slave than the other slaves.